From a psychiatric point of view, I'd want to start with a little vignette that might give you an idea of what we think is so important about the black movement at this time, what we think is so important about such a matter as black identity. You've probably heard black identity and related terms so much that they're coming out your ears, and you wonder maybe if it just hasn't degenerated into word and rhetoric. Well, I don't think so, and I'd like to talk with you about some of the reasons why I think identity among black people, the rising new tide of identity, is so important, what it can do for all of us. Some years ago, I was supervising a white therapist who was treating a black child. The therapist was a young woman, well trained. The child was brown skin, but clearly Afro-American in origin. And all seemed to be going well, until one point when the therapist asked me what did I think of some material that had been coming up in which the child appeared to be very interested in being white. As a matter of fact, said in a number of different ways that she herself, the child that is, wasn't sure whether she was Negro or white. And this, the therapist thought, was a problem. And I took another look at the child, and as I said, she was brown, little light brown, all the subtle gradations that black people go through. But not in my mind could she have been confused with anything other than someone of Afro-American origins. So I listened, which is what we learned to do in psychiatry for a while, and it became clear that the young woman was confusing the child's attachment to her as a therapist, as a helping person, confusing that with the child's interest in being like her. So happened that the therapist was white, therefore the child was interested in being white. If the therapist had been Tasmanian, the child would have been interested in that. The child was attached to the therapist, not to the race. We spent some time with that, and I asked the therapist how it was that she had gotten so confused on this matter. She said she'd read a book by Cardinal and Ovesey, The Mark of Oppression. And I was reminded of that book, which many of you may know about, and I reread it and was again made angry by it. It's an unfortunate book. I happened to be in Harlem at the time the research was being done for it. It was done by, well, at that time, Abram Cardner and Lionel Ovesey were well-to-do psychoanalysts down on Park Avenue, and they came up to Harlem and set up shop, so to speak, in a little Episcopal church on 138th Street, and proceeded to flag down blacks as they walked past to ask them, what's it like being black? They offered to pay them, I think it was $1 a throw, to come in and tell about your life. And if they came for 10 or 15 sessions, there was a bonus of $5 or something at the end for having come this number of times. If it sounds gross to you, I'm sorry. I'm simply reporting to you the research on which this particular book was based. It seemed never to occur to a researcher that if you ask a man about his life, tell me everything about your life for a dollar, that you're saying a number of things to him, and that among other things, if he is at all sensible and thoughtful, he's only going to give you a dollar's worth anyway. So that you can't hope to end up with very much. But they wrote a book, and that was the book this therapist referred to and was using. More than I thought about it, and it's widely used, both Price Cobbs and I felt there ought to be something that at least gave another point of view. And it was with that in mind that we began to write Black Rage. Because it seemed that there was infinitely more to being black than anybody seemed in a hurry to write about. That the perception of oneself as a black American included such a wide variety of things, influenced, in fact, so many attitudes, so many ways one impinged on one society, it seemed to have no limit. For example, Price's little girl was reading, little girl's 8 years old, was reading about one of the atrocities, seeing, I guess, on television, hearing about one of the latest atrocities that had been committed in San Francisco, in which two or three off-duty policemen who'd been drinking for about 5 hours in a bar shot down a black man and killed him in the bar. They were, of course, exculpated, exonerated, and for all we know, given a medal. This kind of thing happens every week, every couple of weeks, every week or so, in whatever community you find yourself. But Price's little girl noticed that they said they had tested the murder victim's blood for alcohol to see if he'd been drunk. But nobody bothered to test the blood of the killers who had been drinking for 5 hours, by everybody's testimony, to see if they were drunk. Now, let me again remind you, this is an 8-year-old child who is noticing this distinction. She is beginning to perceive something about the world in which she lives. She's perceiving it in terms of life and death. A man's been killed, essentially because he's black. Blame has been diverted onto the victim, which is a familiar story that most of us have heard. Being 8, she may not have heard it very much, but she was getting the message loud and clear this time, that the man somehow, on account of possibly, conceivably, maybe being drunk, had been slain, and therefore, quote, I assume, it's a good thing. What on earth could this mean to a child? You know, if you think about it, it's a kind of experience that really isn't covered in our developmental texts on child psychology or child psychiatry. What does it mean to a child to learn serially that because of the color of her skin, her life is in jeopardy, those she's fond of is in lives are in jeopardy, indeed everything important to her is in jeopardy. There was an episode during the Selma, you know, people talk nowadays about the radicalizing effect of various phenomena. And they talk about the effect of all the riots in Chicago and so on. But I have one vignette of the radicalizing effect of the Selma march across the bridge some years ago, when the troops, I guess, came out with horses and so on and trampled on people. And again, a little child was watching this and asking, why are they doing that to us? All I want to call your attention to is, why are they doing that to us? By 6 or 7, she had seen this as the races divided and her lot unalterably cast with blacks. The psychological implications of this kind of beginning, serial, and continued identification are very interesting. Black kids learn, for example, that the ability of their parents to protect them from some of the depredations of fellow citizens is gravely limited. But the white community, by and large, denies any wrongdoing and says that it is people like the child who are always engaged in wrongdoing. Therefore, when something happens, they've got it coming. There are some less obvious aspects to this. I can remember as a kid myself, I lived in Detroit in an area in which the numbers operators were much more familiar than the postman. We, men would come by and we'd wave and, you know, I was a little toddler. And I'd go next door. The good deed for the day was to go next door and get the lady's number and give it to the numbers man, and I would get a little pat on the back from my parents for doing this good deed. Well, it was very clear that I knew who the numbers man was. It was equally clear that the Detroit Police Department said they didn't know who the numbers man was. Now, if you are this high and you realize you know something that the police don't know, it really, you know, gives you an entirely different view of the world. You can't look at police with the same kind of detached respect, even, that you're supposed to, even if nothing else happened, you know. You can't help but look at them as a bunch of ignoramuses. They're too stupid to see the man come down and go into every house, come out counting his money and writing his stuff down and going down the block, and the cop is sitting there on the corner and he can't figure that out. Now, you know, that kind of experience as a child left me with, I have to say, a very special set of feelings toward police, which I have struggled to overcome but have not found much reason to in the succeeding years. You know, the blacks generally, in the eyes of black kids, as he looks around him, he sees black people pretty much at the bottom of the heap, white people at the top. And being a little scientist, if you know anything about kids, you know that they are very, very causally minded, that, you know, if A and B are together, it must be because somebody put them together, and it must be they must have put them together for a particular reason. If a certain phenomena takes place, it must have happened because of a series of causal effects. So, quite naturally, black kids assume that blacks are inferior, intellectually inferior in every way. Why? Because they're at the bottom of the heap. And if whites are at the top of the heap, then one assumes, therefore, that whites are superior. Now, white people who are involved in the educational system who I am sure know what I am telling you. Make no attempt to dissuade black kids from this reasoning. They're perfectly willing to allow the black youngster to grow up with the notion that there is no black person smart enough to run the state of Illinois, you know. Perfectly willing to let black kids grow up feeling that there's nobody smart enough, black, to run a major corporation, or indeed to run the University of Illinois, you know, or I don't know how many black faculty members there are, but I doubt if the place is running over with them, you know. And people would have one believe that this is because there are the black people are not sufficiently well trained, not sufficiently talented. By implication, you know, the thing speaks for itself. One of the things that struck me not so long ago in going into a second or third grade class, it was around some political event, and somebody asked, "What's a governor?" And the teacher was trying to explain, "What's a state, you know," and so on. And I guess the teacher had used this as an opportunity to do a little project insofar as, you know, circumstances allowed, talk a little bit about this. And it occurred to me that in succeeding years, these kids would begin to see this panoply of white faces, you know, depicting all of the congressmen in the United States and all the senators and all the people who inhabit Washington. It makes you think that, you know, Malcolm X was the one who said, "Don't pass over and dismiss congressmen and senators too lightly, because they are the government." And when you look and see that there are, what, 9 or 10 black congressmen and one senator, what on earth does a teacher say at that point? Does a teacher say, "Well, you see, blacks are disenfranchised in the South, and where half the congressmen in most of the southern states ought to be black. They're not allowed to be." I don't think that's said, you know. When one talks about what does it mean to be black, by omission, the teacher is saying a great many negative things about blackness. There are, for example, the actual and implied statements made by spokesmen for the establishment, whatever that establishment might be, that say to this child, to our hypothetical black child instead, that if he is feeling any kind of oppressive burden from discrimination, it's not on a racial basis. That he's being abused on account of the class structure. He is told that he and his are having a hard time on account of their poor, and you see, all poor people have trouble, therefore that's why the policeman beat your older brother to a pulp the other night. You know, you listen to this, and you wonder, you can't help but wonder, the thoughtful child who looks into the minds of his parents, knowing what they are experiencing, who looks into the minds of people who give him this kind of garbage, what he must come up with. A friend of mine is a cinematographer, and he had spent some years perfecting his craft in Canada, decided to come back and do some work here in the United States. Well, he was offered a job by the government. Who else would hire him? He was offered a job to go down to Arizona and do some photographic things of the beautiful Arizona. While down there with two or three members of his crew, I guess maybe half black, half white, they were riding along and came to a restaurant, went in the restaurant and sat down, discovering only after they'd sat down that there was a crowd of rifle club, rifle-toting types, Minutemen types, in the restaurant. So when the hubbub began, my friend got his crowd together and they dashed out, got in their car, and zipped away. The rifle toters were chasing behind them in a car, and a wild ride followed with shots, bang, bang, and it was right out of a movie. But my friend managed to get away. It was a terrifying, as you can imagine, experience. He immediately left Arizona and went back to New York. Now, in New York, he went up to a white colleague and said, "Do you know what happened to me?" and proceeded to tell him this hair-raising tale. Whereupon, the white colleague said, "Well, are you sure they were really after you? You know, I mean, it could have been some boys that had a couple of beers too much and just, you know." Now, my friend had made a judgment which had saved his life, so far as he could tell. And in recounting this to a white colleague, the white colleague was raising question about his ability to appropriately evaluate his environment. And it's the evaluation of that environment on which his life hinges. My point is that one of the reasons black people herd together is to find someone who will say, "Is that right? Did they really do that? Man, I know what you went through." You see, you have to have that kind of confirmation without questioning. You have to know the environment in which you live, and you have to know what people are capable of, and you have to be able to support a colleague without having him bring back fingerprints and tire tracks and so on to prove to you that the gun, you know, gun bearers were after him. We can't, life is too swift. We just don't have time for that. The kids, black kids, on the other hand, have an additional problem, burden. They are inclined to believe what their parents tell them. And it's really very difficult for a youngster any time, let's say in the past 70 years in this country, to have a clear picture of the world around him, to have a clear picture of the world as he sees it in his home, and to believe what his parents tell him and not find any contradiction in that. His parents have to lie to him, you see. If they have wanted, up until very recently, if they have wanted him to get an education, they've had to tell him that an education is going to make an awful lot of difference. It really hasn't, you know, it really hasn't. I suppose statistically, and a friend of mine is fond of juggling statistics, but without juggling even, there's every evidence that blacks are economically falling farther behind whites more rapidly with each passing year. Now, I suppose you could say that since numerically and proportionately more blacks have been educated in recent years, that the fall, the falling behind, would have been even more rapid had not that new educated cadre stepped up. But you could also take the other tack, and you could say it really doesn't matter what blacks do, that the institutions have been set in motion to keep us at the bottom of the heap. And it really doesn't matter. So that the youngster who believes his parents, who say education makes a difference, has to also blot out a great deal of reality. And you see, we can't afford to close our eyes to very much reality. We have to watch carefully. So that it's rather hazardous experience. So hazardous. One of the things in our new book, one of the things we're concerned about in that book, is what kind of psychological maneuvers have blacks had to go through, or have blacks gone through, in order to stay halfway sane all these years, you know. What lies have we had to tell ourselves? Indeed, what lies have there have been believable enough to help? Obviously, one of the chiefest lies and tales has been the religious one. And from that comes the title of the book, The Jesus Bag. But the problems of being black have been so grave that they really are the appropriate matter for psychological study. Not too long ago, when the soldiers were coming through San Francisco, streaming into Vietnam from the United States, I had an experience of being called to by the you know, I love these vigilante groups that spring up. I've forgotten the name. It was the Black Man's Free Law Group or something like that. That was, but not exactly that, because they were concerned with rights of soldiers, rights of black soldiers. And this group had sprung up out of nowhere. And the minute I heard about them, I was delighted to, you know, lock arms with them. So they called me once and said they had a really terrible case and we've got to do something about this and so on. So it turned out that a black soldier who was on his way to Vietnam was frankly psychotic. He was just out of it. He had been psychotic a long time before. They drafted him anyhow and he was just talking out of his head. Now, among the things he said as he was talking in an incoherent, unreasonable, you know, irrational way, something like black power every now and then. That was enough. The army then assumed that he was a political activist who was refusing to go to Vietnam on political grounds. This guy had wandered away from the base because he didn't know where he was going. And he'd wandered into the hands of my friends. Now, we through him, we were able to save this young man. But we also found out that the army was on the alert for what it considered to be political activist rebels, and that there was an accepted way of handling them. Once they were laid hold of, they were put on a plane, zipped over to Saigon, put on another plane, zipped up to the front, given a gun, and sent out on patrol. And another friend of mine collected several instances of mothers who got telegrammed from the War Department before they knew their son was in Vietnam. It seemed very clear that these young men were being all but executed. And I wonder how many of them were as confused as the young man we found, who in his maunderings and talking just mentioned black power, which was enough to condemn him to this kind of thing. The results of some of the conditioning that's gone on are intriguing It turns out that nowadays, as people are trying to help black people who've been over the hill psychologically, try to help them get back, the concept of blackness is a very helpful one. It turns out that when a man is very sick, he cannot comprehend anything about the black movement, nor about blackness itself. But as he begins to get better, it's one of the first things he can lay hold of. It's one of the first things that begin to make sense to him. And it's often around the structure of what is essentially, for him, a political movement, that he is able to restructure his emotional well-being. It's a fascinating and intriguing little fallout from the whole black movement. The importance, it seems, therefore, to us is a far-reaching one. The importance of a man knowing something about blackness and about how he is treated in this country. It has meaning not only for his own psychological well-being, but for the position he occupies in this country. I know a man who was standing outside his house once when his daughter drove up in her car, followed by a police car. His daughter was engaged in a spirited exchange with the policeman, and there was a great disagreement back and forth. The girl then went in the house to get a camera and brought her mother came out with him, and the mother, being fiery-tempered also, both of them were giving the policeman a tongue-lashing. Now, at this point, the policeman went into his car, got some mace, came out, maced mother and daughter, put them in the back of his car, and drove off with them. Father was standing watching. Now, you know, when you talk about identity, when you talk about being black, when you talk about, indeed, what has happened to Afro-Americans in this country, I think this kind of instance, this kind of incident, ought to take a prominent place. Here is a man who has been so castrated by the system that he does not know what to do when these horrible acts are committed in front of his eyes on his wife and daughter. Seems to me that he probably didn't know why they were being mistreated. I imagine if you had asked him, he might have said, well, maybe they did something wrong. Maybe they're being maced, maybe they're being taken down because they talk too loud, because of this, because of something, I don't know. It would seem to me that what he missed, the use to which he put his reasoning, was to justify his fear, to say that in effect they were not treated that way on account of their blackness, which was the real reason, was the only reason. Seems to me that nowadays a black man or woman is beginning to realize a curious fact that sociologists are reluctant to recognize, and that is that there's no such thing as a black man who is exempt from the kind of treatment I've just described. We may react to it differently, but we are all of us subject to this kind of treatment if we live where? In the United States. Now, what this means is that there's no such thing as a middle-class Negro. I am often fascinated by white people who are happy to divide blacks into a great many compartments and say, well, this is a professional Negro, and this is a middle-class Negro, and this is a rich Negro, and this is a poor Negro, and this is, you know. And I challenge you to find me a black man living in Mississippi, no matter how much money he makes, who would be capable of protecting his family, who would be capable of bringing the instruments of that community to his own hand, to using them as a middle-class person is supposed to do. By definition, you know, the money is a shorthand way of talking about power. We generally say a middle-class person, $10,000, $15,000 and up, we say by his earnings, we make a shortcut statement, say he has certain power in his community. Well, part of that power is to be able to summon the instrumentalities of that community for his own purposes, for his own protection. In the greater part of these United States, blacks cannot summon the instrumentalities of their community for their protection, no matter how much money they make. And that means that there is no such thing as a middle-class Negro. Now, it seems to me that if we understand where we fit, if blacks understand where they fit in America, you know, then what we have in a child who's developing that awareness is a growing awareness of how important we are, even though we are relegated to the lowest socioeconomic level. We are vitally important to America. We are at the root, you know, of the whole Haynesworth-Carswell mess, you know. The whole reason for this hassle and this urgency to put mediocrity on the high court is so that they can find somebody mediocre enough to interpret laws, somebody stupid enough to interpret the Constitution and law. In a way that oppresses us. See? That's the whole purpose of it, to find somebody who can misuse us. That's a, you know, intriguing situation. Great many people find the Attorney General Mitchell to be a curious phenomena. Has developed a whole class of Mitchell watchers, you know. What did he do now? Well, he did this, you know, he did that. No. Mitchell, it is sort of assumed, is probably the most powerful man in the Nixon administration and probably the most archaic throwback to something pre-human that he's got there. Let me give you an example. Let me give you an example of what Mitchell wants to do in Washington, D.C. You know that they're trying to frame a new set of laws to deter people from committing crimes in Washington, D.C. Essentially, Mitchell wants it arranged so that the defendant may be detained without trial as many as 60 days if a judge feels that releasing him under bail would pose a danger to the community. The burden of proving otherwise would rest with the defendant. Mitchell wants it arranged so that police may enter private premises day or night and without announcement seize evidence or make arrests. Under this no-knock provision, it would be illegal for anyone on the premises to resist arrest. He wants it arranged that judges be allowed to impose life sentences upon any persons convicted of 3 felonies. And felony is something I'm told is defined by money. The reason Mitchell is there in the administration is because of us. See, the rest of America would not be burdened with Mitchell if it were not for blacks. The whole idea of law and order and keeping us in line was one of Nixon's campaign promises to white Southerners and white bigots. We are the reason that Mitchell is inflicted on the nation. We are a pretty important 10%. You have only to look at the history books and get some notion about the origins of labor unions to find a very contemporary additional example of our importance. The whole matter of the organization of the free white fraternal order of laborers to protect their rights and so on came about at a time when they were threatened with having black men work in industry. The labor unions have found their origin in a time when the men themselves were threatened by having to work with blacks or having to compete against black workers. And when you have trouble flying, as I did, or trouble mailing a letter, as we all did just a few days ago, and you think, you know, this whole business finds its roots also in us, you get an idea of what the growing black child has to comprehend. He has to comprehend a great big lie in which America says, you're unimportant. You know, blacks, you're unimportant. You don't do anything. You don't accomplish anything. You don't make any money. You don't make any contribution to the national wealth, and so on and so on and so on. I love that story about, you know, asking the average Cadillac owner, what do you think about the new Cadillac? You know, I think it's a fine machine myself. Well, the idea is that General Motors nor any other mammoth corporation dare not allow it be known that their wealth rests in large measure on us. Because somehow or other, the instrumentalities of wealth, which are the great corporations, have to be above and beyond us. The advertisements that were so difficult to come by, black models and so on, even now when you still look, it's fascinating how much more often it is the institutional investor, DuPont, can afford more readily to have a black model than can a dressmaker. Because DuPont is one step removed from the purchaser. The dressmaker, on the other hand, is afraid that their garments will be identified with blacks even now. And if you think this domestic policy, this domestic attitude, which black children have to grow up in and learn something about, if you think it is a limited thing, you have only to realize that our foreign policy has always been a function of our domestic policy. And that it is no incident, that didn't just happen. That we're busy, they are busy killing little brown men in Vietnam, not white men. Psychologically, therefore, it is crucially important that our black children understand these wide-ranging ramifications of blackness. It's important that things be placed, that we help black children place things in perspective, that we help them understand something that a great many white people cannot understand. That, for example, that famous picture of the Cornell students with the bandoliers and the guns and so on, that needs to be set in opposition alongside the picture of Governor Kirk taking over a school district And you have to see what are the objectives of these two groups of people, you know? And who's interested in education? And who's being kept from getting an education? By whom? In both instances, it will be exactly the same. That blacks are interested in learning, and whites don't want them to learn. You know, and that's essentially the story about it. We can't allow black kids any longer to hear stories about welfare chiselers, you know, that beautiful little lilting phrase, well, and not remind them that white businessmen chisel the government in amounts that are so great that you can't even count it and feel it is their right. You know, I thought it was really astounding when Lockheed Corporation said, "We're losing money. Give us $30 million. I wonder what would have happened. Well, I don't have to wonder. I know what would have happened if a poor person had said, "You know, my budget doesn't seem to work. I'll have to have some more money." You know what would have happened. Right now, the government's busy trying to figure out some way to bail out Lockheed. Even more interesting, seems to me, is the way the federal government is capable of saying welfare mothers, you know, and you just pops up in your mind an image of a black woman with seven children and no husband, you know, and she's always that terrible, and that's those welfare mothers, you know. And that it's clear that is what the government wants people to think, you know. It so happens that by anybody's measure, only one in four poor people in this country are black. But the way the imagery is presented, it is as if all welfare mothers, you know, and you don't hear about people who are on welfare and count as too sick to work. You know, they're all welfare mothers who are going someplace to have some more children in order to have some more money, and which doesn't make any sense anyhow. But this ability to use, to defame blacks, and in the course of it, starve three whites for every black that's being starved, it seems to me is a unique talent developed by government administrators. I think it's high time that we remind our children. You know, we have to tell them some pretty complicated things, but these are the facts of life, and if we don't tell them, they're going to grow into disenchanted adults. They're going to accuse us of lying to them, and we can't afford that kind of accusation. America's condition is a very serious one, I think. Seems to me that our rights, civil, constitutional, and human, are in grave danger. The Yahoos are loose in the land. We have a Reagan in California. You know, we've all got a Nixon Agnew in Washington. And in between, we have asses uncounted, you know? You see, mediocrity, this seems to be the age of mediocrity, hardly the age of Aquarius. You look at the kind of terrible oppression that is upon us, and it seems that if we have been successful at all, those of us who've passed through childhood, if we've been successful at all in taking the scales away from our eyes, we have a clearer vision of the future than does any other American. You see, we blacks are the only Americans who in these times know exactly where we're going. We are headed in exactly the same place we were headed before Nixon, Mitchell, and their crowd came on the scene. We cannot turn around. You know, there's no way in the world we can be confused with a silent majority. You know, they have only to look at us, and they know exactly what we want. We can't hide it. We couldn't if we would, you know. We're determined to rid this nation of bigotry and racial hatred. We have been determined. We still are determined. There's no alternative. You know, we are like sailors who have nailed the rudder in a certain direction, set the sails in a certain, and we're sailing in a particular direction. We're on a particular course. We cannot turn around. It makes no sense for someone to say to us, you know, be pragmatists, you know. There is no such thing as being black and being pragmatic, you know. If you are black, you define revolution in this country. We're the only people who cannot tolerate America to remain the way it's been. It has to change for us. So I would say, and I want to stop at this point, that to whites who feel similarly, that is, that America is in a desperate condition, we say to you, share the fruits of the battle we are on our way to win. You know? Come and help us. Our eyes are open and will never be closed again. This is something people can't seem to understand. You know, they think that, well, you know, they can change this and change that and benign neglect and all that sort of business. We'll go back. We can't go back. It's impossible for us. The bridges are burned back there. We can't go back. We've got to be headed directly forward. In the midst of this kind of struggle, I would say that there is no such thing as a black man who is too radical. The two things don't go together. Radicalness, revolutionary posture, equal blackness. We have to change it. We have to change it. We can't ever give up. We'll never give up. We'll press on. We'll fight on. Right on.